Again, welcome everyone. And I'm Carla Brennan, and I'm one of the primary teachers here. And my talk today is a talk about why speech. Although I'm going to be focusing on a particular part of the aspect of it. I know some of you, and I don't know some of you, so I don't know what people's background is, but why speech comes up in two very important lists in the Buddhist tradition. One is, it's one of the five precepts, and the precepts are about how to live in a non-harming way, and it also comes up as part of the Eightfold Path. Now, most people, when they talk about wise speech or think about wise speech, think of it as this out loud talking that we do with each other. But I'm going to talk about it in a different way. So I'm going to ask the question, who are we talking to actually most of the time? Who are we talking to? Right? We're blabbing to ourselves most of the time. That's the person who we're actually most in communication with, sometimes it seems like a dialogue, sometimes it seems like a whole, I don't know, meeting. In a meeting, sometimes it's just an ongoing monologue. And it's certainly the sort of the commentary. I don't know if you have the commentary voice, like life is a documentary, and Richard Attenborough is back there in my voice telling me about everything that's going on. So we have this going on a lot in our mind. We're talking to ourselves about our life, about ourselves, about others, about what's happening in the moment, the past and future. So this talk is called Inner Wise Speech or Wise Self-Talk. I will start by saying it is my premise that a lot of this, how we, in what way, and what we say to ourselves, is the source of, can be the source of a lot of our suffering. There's really two ways thoughts happen in the mind, just oversimplify a little bit. One is that thoughts arise due to past conditioning. This is the kind of a thought pops into your mind variety of thought. And a fair amount of our thoughts are like that. And the more you meditate, the more you're familiar with that thoughts just sort of come and they go, and they just sort of pop out of nowhere, and they say the strangest things at times, especially if you're on long retreat. The mind will just sort of pop out in either words or images, memories from the third grade will suddenly unfold, some strange fantasy, you'll see somebody and suddenly the thought that, you know, will pop. That person is a complete jerk, you know, and you're like, where did that come from? I don't even know that person, but these thoughts come out, or the thought will come out, you know, I need to eat some Jell-O right now, and you haven't eaten Jell-O in 30 years, but that thought comes into your mind, and you feel like you need to act on it or not. So these kind of thoughts, which are due to past conditioning, it's like a storage, it's almost like a, if you use the computer analogy, there's all this memory and stuff in there, and something sort of just clicks a few bytes in there, or a few neurons, and something comes out into our consciousness. And for the most part, we have no direct control over these, and you don't really even need to control them. They're just kind of arisings that happen. The practice we're doing does, in a sense, have an effect on these over time, the way they pop up, or how many pop up, or the power of them will change over time with our practice. The other thing, actually, we can, if we do, you may know this, but if you do specific, very intense concentration practices, you can actually temporarily interrupt that from happening, but it's only temporary. So the second type of thought, and this is the type that I'm really addressing, is the type of I might call it semi-volitional, semi-conscious thinking that we do in response to what's happening or thoughts we have. So we add to it, we feed things, we have these habitual, which I'm separating a little bit from conditioned, habitual patterns of thinking that come up. And these we can, like any habit, we can actually change and do things with. So there's, we all have familiar patterns, and I'm guessing that some of you are somewhat familiar with some of your patterns, maybe not all of them. When I first began meditation, I was attracted to it because I just wanted my mind to shut up. I was looking for some relief because my mind was endlessly going on and on and on in ways that were, just so overwhelming and so uncomfortable and so depressing and in a way that seemed to dominate my experience. And we all have different experiences. I haven't been in, thank God, I haven't been in everybody's head to know. I'm sort of glad I can't, really read minds. To know what your particular experience of your self-talk and your inner dialogue monologue is. But I'm sure there are commonalities between all of us. And when I was a child, I was pretty quiet and pretty shy, and I felt somewhat neglected. I often felt alone. And I think I developed a pretty elaborate inner world of self-talk. And that may be true for most of us, or many of us. And I kind of depended on it for companionship, in a sense. And I think some of the patterns of self-talk were the critical, judgmental type, that we learn from because that's what other people do, so we think we have to do that to ourselves. Some of it was perhaps self-soothing inner talk, and some was maybe just distracting inner talk, and as I said, some was sort of to keep me company, and some was just, other patterns of, distorted neurotic thinking. And all of these are kind of coping strategy. So we have in us this patterns of self-talk that we've developed to cope. And sometimes they're useful coping strategies, but I'd say over time, and as an adult, they often become less useful. So there's sort of two. There's two types of thoughts, the ones that just pop out of conditioning, and then the habitual patterns. And then there's two areas in which we can look about how we bring in more of a sense of wise inner speech or wise self-talk. One is in the tone or attitude we have towards ourselves, and therefore how our speech arises and how we work with it. And the other is in the looking at the beliefs, the assumptions, and the interpretations of our patterns of self-talk. So this tone or attitude that we have is more of an emotional, energetic ground, you might say. Some of us may have a pretty bad attitude towards ourselves. Some of you may have at this point have developed a pretty good attitude. I know some of you have been practicing a long time and have done a lot of work with yourself, so you may feel pretty comfortable with that at this point. I don't know. But the Buddha said there's four qualities to wise speech, four things to be considered before you begin to speak. And is what you're saying truthful? Is it beneficial? Is it kind? And is it timely? Is it truthful? Is it beneficial? Is it kind? Is it timely? And again, we usually think of these in terms of when we speak to others, but what about when you are speaking to yourself? Are you actually engaging in speech and a kind of inner context setting, you might even say, with these qualities in mind? again, some of us, you know, the more you practice mindfulness and pay attention to the mind, the more you begin to recognize when this is or isn't happening, when you're being hooked by old patterns and when you're actually allowing a more conscious and kind way of relating to yourself arise. So this tone or attitude is really about the quality of kindness that we extend ourselves, the kind of understanding that we extend to ourselves, the tender, caring, thoughtful, wise way that we respond to our own pain, our own difficulties, our own confusion, our own shortcomings, our own mistakes, our own failures, our own embarrassments. And I'm guessing that we all have some of these. And so do we respond to these with kind of a caring wisdom? Or do we respond to these events of life condemning and feeling ashamed, feeling impatient, feeling harsh? Or just kind of, some people don't maybe get into that so much, but they're somewhat disconnected. They don't actually know what they're feeling. They actually are a little bit out of touch with what's really going on in their inner world. So this tone or attitude can be learned, can be applied consciously. And sometimes it's more of a, it's not even a, the words you use, inner words you use, although it may be, certainly, but it's the way that you hold yourself, the way that you attend to yourself, the way that you, what kind of companion are you to yourself? Are you, most people have some, you know, a little bit of rejection or abandonment issues. And yet we reject and abandon the person that we're really, who is really abandoning and rejecting us as ourselves. To really begin to see the ways in which you might be doing that. And to see the ways in which you can bring more of a sense of holding yourself like you would hold a loved one. And I mean sort of literally, physically holding, but in a sort of energetic way. Do you hold yourself in that way? The Buddha said, there is no one in this world more deserving of your love than you. He would also have said, there is no one in this world less, more or less deserving of your love than you. It was, everybody is, but you are in, you are of equal deservedness of this love. And sometimes we, in the West, don't quite get that, don't know what that means. We know about, you know, kind of ego and aggrandizement. We know about feeling superior or inferior, but we don't really know about sometimes the simple quality of care and love and attention to oneself. So I'm asking you to begin to pay attention to the quality, the tone, and the attitude of your inner voice, particularly when you're dealing with a difficult situation, when you're dealing with something that you feel uncomfortable about yourself. Something you did, something you said, something about your character, something about your personality, something you don't like about yourself. So the other part of this is, as I said earlier, is looking at, so we have the tone and quality of this inner voice, of the way we speak to ourselves. And of course I want to say in meditation and in mindfulness we often have the opportunity to drop it altogether. And that is some of the point of practice, is that whether we drop, we are so present and we are paying attention and we are here and here and now, that all of that drops away and that there is freedom and there is ease, and there is presence, and there is no problem. So that is the direction much of our practice is taking us. However, in the meantime, and for all those times where our mind is busy blabbing, and when we're in some kind of internal conflict or we're suffering, it is very important to look at this inner conceptual life, this inner relationship with ourselves. So we look at the beliefs, the assumptions, interpretations, the patterns, the habitual patterns of beliefs, interpretations, and assumptions. And this kind of goes, these particularly go under the category of what we say or what we think. Is it truthful and is it beneficial? Is it truthful and is it beneficial? If we honestly look, a lot of what we are attached to, our beliefs and assumptions, aren't really based in any fundamental truth and may often not be all that beneficial. Again, that's, you know, depending on how much spiritual work, personal work you've done, that may or may not be. You may have developed a better inner barometer of truthfulness and beneficiality. So our habitual patterns of reacting with beliefs, assumptions, and interpretations are ways that we often meet and mediate events of our life. This is also an important aspect. These are important aspects of our identity project. Who we think we are, what we think about reality, what we think of others, how we get attached to these. And they are also, again, very often the patterns that cause us suffering. So some familiar ones here, you know, you can probably add to the list. One pattern of beliefs, assumptions, interpretations relates to worry and catastrophizing. Very common practice. A practice I would suggest you try not to practice. We all have practices that we're doing. And mindfulness is a nice practice, and meditation, but we have practiced, many of us have the practice of worry. And we got really good at it. I have a 90-year-old father who has perfected the practice of worry, and he is incapable, actually, pretty much it seems at this point, of not worrying and not being anxious, because he did it so well for so many years. And he doesn't, I don't think, understand that there is another option. The more you practice something, the better you'll get at it. So pay attention to what you will actually practice. So worry and catastrophizing is one set of beliefs and assumptions that something will happen, and we'll think, well, the thought about the future, we'll apply these beliefs and assumptions, and then we'll worry about it. Oh, this is going to happen, that's going to happen, what if this, and I'm going to be that, and, you know, whatever it is that we do. Another type of this type of inner talk is around comparing. And comparing is we're in some, usually often in a frequent assessment of ourselves as being inferior or superior to whatever or whomever is around. So we're always going, am I better or am I worse? Am I better or am I worse? And this can happen almost automatically. And this is a great activity of the ego part of the mind. It's very interested in this. Seeing where it fits in. I'm better and worse. I'm better and worse. When I'm better, I get to feel a little bit okay for a while. And if I'm worse, then I get to feel bad for a while. And most of us do some kind of vacillating between these. We may have a bigger identity with the feeling inferior, but we often have moments of grandiosity where we're feeling quite, you know, if people only knew, really, they only knew how great I was. It's too bad they don't. And then when it's inferior, it's kind of like, I really hope people don't know what I'm really like. So this kind of ranking, this kind of comparison, and according to the suttas that this kind of thinking takes a long time to dissolve. It's one of the last to go as we become more awakened. But there's a lot of identity caught in this. There's a lot of beliefs caught in this. What you think about ourselves and others, assumptions about self and other, interpretations going on and on and on. It's a real drag, to be honest. It takes a lot of energy, causes a lot of suffering, it causes a lot of conflict. Sort of related to this is, there's many other ways of rationalizing, justifying, generalizing, all kinds of ways where we have habits of seeing what's going on and adding our whole story to it and making assumptions, coming to conclusions based on our story, not on what's actually happening. And then we may have patterns of just ignoring, neglecting, or minimizing. Many of us kind of shut down. We just don't pay attention at all. And this creates a kind of dullness or a lack of insightfulness, a lack of actually being able to respond to what's going on. So I'm encouraging you to be very active and be very strong in noticing these patterns in yourself with compassion and with clarity. And meditation, years of meditation can help one be very mindful to sort of see them come again and come and go. Certainly certain kinds of therapy can help you be more aware of these. So when you're dealing with beliefs, assumptions, and interpretations, the simple question, you know, I said about being, is it true? The simple question of asking yourself again and again when you have some idea, belief, is it absolutely true? Is it totally true? Is it true? Is it happening now? That's a good one for projections into the future. Is it happening now? Is there anything but now? And then as you see these patterns, is it helpful? Is this way of thinking, is this reaction, is this assumption, is this interpretation actually helpful? And it gives us a moment to stop and to actually see what we're doing, the impact it has on ourselves and others. So one thing I would say that any sort of habit or anything that we've developed that may seem unhelpful actually can usually be transformed into something that is helpful. You don't have to get rid of it. It's almost like you bring wisdom and compassion to it, and it will transform into something helpful. So one thing I've noticed in this over years of practice, that this tendency, as I said earlier, I have this maybe overdeveloped inner self-talking world that I've seen it transform into from what sometimes wasn't helpful into the power of reflection, the ability to consciously reflect. Reflection is what I would call the skillful, compassionate, directed use of thought. A skillful and compassionate directed use of thought. So most of us, our thinking is kind of driving us in an unconscious way. And yet the Buddha said, the mind is your friend, the mind is your enemy. The mind is your friend, the mind is your enemy. Meaning that without training, the mind will take us places, it will rule us, the conditioned mind will make us crazy, will make us do things that cause suffering. But with wisdom and understanding, there's tremendous power in our mind. And that one of those powers is the ability to reflect. And this reflection means to really reflect on what is the nature of reality, What are these teachings that we're getting? What does it mean for myself? How do I apply it? What does it really mean? So you can't just get teachings and like sit there. You have to actually own them, digest them, understand them for yourself, and know how to skillfully apply them for yourself. So often now, when I'm hurt, or I'm hurting in some way, or in pain in some way, or feel that contracted, dreadful, inner, yucky feeling, I know that's a signal or a cue. That's a signal or a cue to be kind. It's a signal or a cue to pay attention. It's a signal or a cue that some belief system is operating. Some assumption, some old pattern is in operation right now. So, you know, what I do is I literally have little sit-down talks with myself. That's one way I use wise self-talk. Which means I don't necessarily do it aloud, although I've been known to say things aloud. but it means I stop. I recognize there's something going on here, and I'm getting spun out. You know, I'm getting obsessive about something. I'm getting spun out in anxiety about something. I'm whatever it is. And then it's like, stop. I have to stop, reflect, and breathe. Stop, breathe, reflect. And in that moment, it's like, okay, I'm getting off balance here. I need to call forth my wisest self. And sometimes I get a little, you know, rebellious with myself. I don't want to, you know, whatever it is. And then sometimes you have to practice a little bit of tough love with yourself. You have to be quite disciplined, but in the kindest of way. I often say to myself, and this is easy because I was a therapist and I'm a teacher, I will say to myself, what would I say to someone else in this situation? What would I say? Because I'm in a situation a lot of having to say, give people feedback and so forth. So what would I say to someone else? And then I listen to myself. I listen to myself and I'll take it in. And, you know, I might have to tell myself, you know, this is what's happening. This is the way it is. I have to remind myself what I know to be true. I'll have to ask myself, what do I need right now? And I might ask myself, what is the most kind and beneficial thing right now? And also, maybe, what is the right thing to do at this point? Sometimes there's something that needs to be done. An apology, or a phone call, or whatever it is. You know, if I'm frightened by something, or anxious about something, it might be, okay, this thing is happening, this is the way it is, means this thing is happening, and you're experiencing some anxiety right now. What do I know to be true? I know that in this moment there's not a problem. I know how to breathe. I know how to relax. What do I need right now? Well, it might be I need to actually remind myself that I can cross that bridge when it comes and I don't have to be concerned about it now. And what is most kind and beneficial? Maybe I just need to take a break. I need to meditate. I need to relax. I need to take a nap. And what is the right thing to do? Maybe I need to cancel something. Maybe I need to get help. Whatever it is. So I'm forced to a bit as a I guess I'm not forced to, but because I'm a teacher, it's like, oh, I got to walk my talk all the time. It's this extra pressure. And so it's really looking at really investigating what leads to more inner freedom. So again, as I have a sit-down talk with myself, I remind myself what's really important, my priorities, what my real intentions are. My intention is to no longer create suffering for myself. That is one of my biggest intentions. And what I like to say is developing a fierce determination to not add suffering to the world. And sometimes you have to bring a sense of humor. Sometimes I think, if this weren't so painful, it'd actually be pretty funny. So sometimes I'll think about that. And sometimes it just feels tragic. And at that point, when something really difficult happens, and that's when we identify, when we need to open to the larger experience of life and humanity, and acknowledge our imperfections, our fallibility, our flaws, our woundedness, and to also recognize we have enormous potential and we have Buddha nature. So I think I'll stop there. So let's just take a moment of silence.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.